It is that nervous system that is unconscious within our body, but it affects everything. So the autonomic nervous system is the system that helps you breathe. It's the system that dilates and contracts, so expands and shrinks your blood vessels. It's the one that controls your heart rate, your ability to sweat, how your pupils get smaller and bigger, all these responses and actions that we don't necessarily, well, that we don't consciously control. And what's happening, or what we're discovering is with concussion, is that this system can become affected.
There is always hope, and you are not alone.
Hi, I'm Christabel Braden, and this is my brain injury podcast, Hope Survives. Here we share information, education, and support for the brain injury community. This is an uplifting podcast to bring hope to your darkest days. As a survivor of traumatic brain injury and multiple concussions, I know what it's like to struggle to find hope. I don't want anyone to feel as alone as I did, and that's why I started my online community called Hope After Head Injury. This podcast is an extension of that, and I'd love to invite you to join along as we explore the realities of life with brain injury, with messages of encouragement, interviews with doctors and professionals, and survivor stories. No matter where you're at on your journey, there is always hope.
With a little hope, you can make it through today. With a little faith, someday you'll get through the pain. Just a little love is enough to light the way through your darkest night. Hope survives. Hope survives.
Welcome back to Hope Survives Podcast. On the brain injury and concussion journey, there are so many different pieces to our symptoms, to our struggles, and sometimes it can be so overwhelming trying to figure out what piece of the puzzle is causing what symptoms. And so on this podcast, you'll hear me share a lot of my journey and how it took a lot of time for the pieces to come together. This isn't really an overnight process, but it's something that we learn and grow over time. And that's why I do this podcast and why I'm so passionate about it, because I really hope that it helps you to understand what could be going on in your journey or your loved one's journey, or if you're a clinician, your patient's journey. Last week, I shared a lot more personal pieces of my story as related to my mental health journey and some of the struggles that I've gone through with dealing with an abusive relationship and what that looked like. And as a survivor, how do you cope with different things that happen in your life? And what does it mean to live with symptoms for so many years? How does that affect your self-worth? And I really appreciated some of the messages that you sent me about that episode. So I just want to thank you for that, because it definitely got more personal than most of my episodes. But in that episode, and in many of the times that I talk about my journey, dysautonomia is mentioned. And that is because the autonomic nervous system is a piece of the puzzle that I found out was affecting my brain injury, or was affecting my symptoms, back in 2019. So it's only been a couple years since I've received the dysautonomia diagnosis. And to put some perspective into that, my brain injury was 2007. So it was quite a long time before I learned about this. But this piece of the puzzle is the thing that changed my life. And so back in season one, I had Dr. Jeremy Schmo on the podcast. He's a functional neurologist, and he's actually my doctor. And he came on to talk about dysautonomia in general. Now, today, I've invited Natasha Welch on to dive deeper into this topic, because I don't think it's talked about enough, but you hear it mentioned in almost every single one of these episodes. The person that I'm interviewing usually mentions the autonomic nervous system because in more recent years of research, it's become super apparent that the autonomics is a driving factor in symptoms after concussions and brain injuries. And so today, Natasha is here to break this down for us. She is a physical therapist, and she's worked and specialized in concussions. She also has a personal connection to brain injury, which she'll share in the interview, someone in her family. And she's super passionate about helping survivors. And so today, she's here to break down the basics. What is the autonomic nervous system? What is the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems? How can it be disrupted after a concussion or brain injury? What is the difference between dysautonomia and POTS? And what are some practical things you can do to improve autonomic function? It is a very informative episode. She breaks it down for us, and I just hope it helps you to understand what's going on, maybe inside your own head or inside your own body, or again, your loved one. And so thank you so much for listening and supporting the Hope Survives podcast. You guys, your listeners, you're what helps me to keep going and the reason that I do this. And so, of course, I always love to hear from you. Reach out anytime at Hope After Head Injury on Instagram, website hopeafterheadinjury.com, or my personal email is Christabel@hopeafterheadinjury.com. Thanks for listening, and let's move on with the show. I started Hope After Head Injury 10 years ago, and it has grown into a global online support community. You can get involved and check out more of the online resources we have available at hopeafterheadinjury.com. Connect with survivors, caregivers, and family members through our Zoom meetings, our Facebook support group, or the Brain Injury Bible Study group. I remember what it's like to feel so alone with brain injury, and my goal with these groups is for you to know that you are not alone and to be able to connect with others going through similar circumstances. We are in this together. Now, I want to thank you for listening to the podcast and remind you that this podcast is for education and informational purposes only and not intended for medical advice. If you need specific medical advice, please consult your physician. Now, thanks for listening, and let's get on with the show. Today, I am so excited to welcome back Natasha Wilch to Hope Survives podcast. You may remember Natasha from season one. You did two episodes with me?
Yeah, we did two episodes.
We did two episodes on season one. She's wonderful. I'm always sending people to the episode you did on ways to calm symptoms. And I've gotten so much feedback about how much that episode has helped people. So thank you again for always being willing to share.
Always a pleasure to come join you.
Yes, I'm so excited. And today, Natasha could talk about anything in brain injury recovery. She's actually, and I can let her talk about this a little bit, but she's launching a program for educating concussion or educating providers on how to better treat patients with concussions. And so she really is very well-rounded in knowing a lot of different things as far as the brain injury and concussion recovery goes. But I have asked her to specifically focus today on the autonomic nervous system. And that is because it is one of those things you can't see on the outside, but so many of us have struggles with our autonomics without knowing it or without knowing why. And then if you do realize you have struggles with autonomics, how do you even tackle it? So we're going to dive in. But before we get into that topic specifically, Natasha, can you just introduce yourself a little bit about who you are, why you're passionate about recovery, and you can share a little bit about your new program.
Sure. So again, thank you for having me back. I love coming to chat with you. So for those that don't know me, my name is Natasha Wilch, and I am a registered physical therapist over up here in Western Canada on Vancouver Island. And I own a brick and mortar clinic called Symphony Rehab. I have just launched my online program for clinicians called Concussion Nerds, because I'm a giant nerd. And what I love about that program is it's truly multidisciplinary in nature. We have professions, a ton of different professions that have been enrolled. It's super exciting, but it's to create this space of a collective voice to help us evolve and elevate this conversation and culture of concussion, because they truly believe it's going to be this unique blend of the front end clinicians and people who've gone through these journeys who are truly going to be the ones who change the way the world views, treats, and approaches concussion and mild and brain injury. So that's kind of the big piece behind it. Cliff notes of where my passion comes from, because I could talk way too long. My dad sustained a brain injury when I was 17 years old. And 21 years ago, you didn't rehab any of that, right? And no one informed him what that could look like for his life. No one talked to my mom. And no one let 17-year-old me or 15-year-old, my 15-year-old brother, understand what that could look like. And it was a trying, time, and and navigating it was, well, we didn't know how, and that actually led to me moving out of my parents' house when I was 17 years old, and just led to some life scenarios. And, luckily today my dad is doing great. I always have to say that part so people know my dad is doing great. We have an amazing relationship. Our journey, because of his brain injury actually, and some of the events that happened after, led to us reconnecting on a deeper level than I think we ever would have connected with before. So in that sense, that is a beautiful blessing and gift that came from the scenario. But when I started treating, I started seeing clients come in and they would share their stories. And I started seeing a little bit of what we had gone through, except that it was 21 years later and there was no reason for people to be experiencing those things today. So it kind of lit a fire in my belly. And now I'm on this mission to, when I say truly, elevate and evolve the conversation and culture of concussion around the world. So yeah, that's a bit about me.
Thank you so much for sharing. And thanks for sharing some of your personal experience with brain injury. You know, I always think brain injury is one of those things you don't really understand unless you have a connection to it, or you've been through it, or you've seen someone go through it. And so I admire you, and I appreciate that you allowed that passion to come out to help others with everything you've gone through. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I always say there's, you know, I'm never going to completely understand because I haven't lived it. But I can empathize, and then have my experience of that loved one to kind of pull in. So there's always going to be pieces that I'm like, I do my best, but I'll never have that firsthand experience.
Yeah. Being a family member is pretty much as close as you can get without it being a survivor yourself. So I appreciate that perspective. So today we're going to talk about the autonomic nervous system. The reason that I think this is so important, like I said at the beginning, it's something you can't see, but something that so many survivors deal with. So first of all, can you just talk about what is the autonomic nervous system and how can it be affected after a brain injury?
Yeah. So the autonomic nervous system, first of all, like its name presents, it's autonomic. So it is that nervous system that is unconscious within our body, but it affects everything. So the autonomic nervous system is the system that helps you breathe. It's the system that dilates and contracts, so expands and shrinks your blood vessels. It's the one that controls your heart rate, your ability to sweat, how your pupils get smaller and bigger. All these responses and actions that we don't necessarily, well, that we don't consciously control. And what's happening, or what we're discovering, is with concussion is that this system can become affected. So ultimately, when we talk about it, we talk about two major branches of the autonomic nervous system. We talk about our parasympathetic nervous system and our sympathetic nervous system. Now, we need both to survive, but our parasympathetic system is commonly kind of referred to as our rest and digest. So it's the system that's active when we are calm, when we feel safe. It's the one that we have that slower heart rate. Your skin and your digits are warm. you digest your food, right? It has motility for digestion. Your pupils are normal size, let's say. And so it falls into this brain. But your sympathetic system is basically its counterpart. So your sympathetic, people will refer to as fight, flight, or freeze. So I've just started doing a lot of reading about the polyvagal theory, which I find really fascinating. We won't dive into it today a little bit, but it takes this concept and takes it a step further, which I love. But in the sympathetic system, fight, flight, or freeze. So it's either mobilizing your internal systems to help you run the heck away. So this is where your heart rate picks up. Your pupils get really big and dilated so you can take in more light and more in your environment. You might sweat here. Your blood gets redirected to the major muscles to help you move. So it gets pulled away from things like digestion, right? So it's literally mobilizing you because there's a threat. So safety is not present when our sympathetic system fires up. The other layer is freeze, which is different than mobilize. So freeze is when basically everything starts to shut down and immobilize you. Think about when you're running, you know, how were you ever taught that if you see, I don't know if this is true, but if you see a bear, you play dead so that it doesn't attack you. I grew up in the Kootenays.
You grew up in Canada. I'm like, I don't know if we were actually taught anything about bears as children here.
I grew up in the outdoors, in the wilderness. Like we had bears around us all the time. And for some reason, I remember that if you were ever in a scenario with a bear, and this is such a terrible analogy, but you played dead. Because if you were dead, it's not going to chase you, right? It's not interested anymore. Mm-hmm. And so immobilize is everything starts to slow down to conserve whatever energy you have in that threat.
Okay.
Okay. So that's the sympathetic system. What tends to happen after concussion is that there becomes an imbalance between the two systems. And we tend to become more sympathetically dominated, which means we live more in that fight, flight, or for some people, maybe freeze scenario. The effect that can actually have on your life are things like it's going to affect your blood flow, potentially blood flow to the brain. So this is where that concept of exercise intolerance at the first piece comes into play when your providers will look at you have exercise intolerance. This sub-threshold aerobic activity will help us work at a place that's safe to improve blood flow to the brain, because the thought is that it might be being restricted. You might be having issues with constipation, because if you're in fight or flight, you don't have the motility and things aren't moving through your digestive system. You may have a more rapid resting heart rate. You might not respond as well to postural changes and have things like dizziness. You may have issues with sleep. You might have really cool, find that your hands and your fingers are suddenly, or hands and your fingers and like your feet are more cold than they ever used to be. It's longer for you, like touch your skin, and it's longer for the blood to come back to your hands. Like these are all symptoms and signs that could indicate that your sympathetic system is just more prominent than your parasympathetic.
Wow. You know, it's so interesting. Every single one of the symptoms you listed, I have had. And I spent so many years after my brain injury, like 10 years, I had over 10 years, I had absolutely no idea. I never even heard of the autonomic nervous system, but everything down to the constipation, down to like cold hands and fingers, like every single thing you're describing, I have lived with for so long. And my brain injury was 2007. I did not get diagnosed with dysautonomia until 2019. That's 12 years. Mm-hmm. And that was 12 years of, I was always off. I would, you know, there were other things too, vestibular issues and things like that. But I'm just sitting here getting emotional hearing you just like list out the things that you don't know how to say when you have a, when you're a survivor, like nobody would think like being constipated has anything to do with your nervous system, you know, like it's just so, I'm getting emotional. So I want you to keep sharing, but I think for our listeners, it's so important to know like the amount of research and the understanding that's come out about brain injury. It brings me so much hope. It brings me so much hope. So thank you, Natasha, for explaining. So you've explained the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system and a little bit about what it looks like when it can be disrupted. Can you talk a little bit more? We've heard the terms dysautonomia, POTS. I know there's different levels and different variations of autonomic dysfunction after a brain injury. So can you kind of explain it in a simple to understand way of, you know, what really can this look like for people?
Yeah. So I also think it's important to know autonomic dysfunction can come from so many different things. And you may have been in a state, depending on the, because we're going to talk about things that affect your autonomics here coming up, I know. So depending on the life you lived before your brain injury, you could have had elements of just like autonomic imbalance, and then your brain injury exacerbated that too, right? So there is a lot of really new research coming out looking at the impact of your autonomic health and what that means for your life, which is fantastic. I do want to say really quickly, there's a tool, because exactly like you said, this is a hard thing to start to bring up with general practitioners, because sometimes, again, that just that bridge of knowing isn't there. There's a tool that you can use. It's called the COMPASS 31. COMPASS number 31. You can find it if you Google it. And there's a short form and a long form. And this is a questionnaire that you can fill out. You don't have to worry about knowing how to interpret it or anything like that, but it's a validated questionnaire that if you completed it and then brought it to your appointment with your doctor or your neurologist, it's a really great way to help have that conversation with you, for you with your practitioner, to say, this is what I'm experiencing. and then they have this validated tool that's been proven in the research to help have this conversation to make this bridge with you. So I just wanted to put that out there.
That's wonderful. You said it's called COMPASS 31.
COMPASS 31.
I will get that information from you, and I will put the information in the show notes on our website.
Perfect. Yeah, it's just, it's a beautiful way to start to, because like you said, it can be really hard to put words to what you're feeling sometimes. Mm-hmm. And this is just a really great way to just say, here, can we talk about all of this that I'm experiencing, please?
Thank you.
Yeah. I completely forgot your question.
It's okay. I was asking about what is dysautonomia, POTS.
Yes.
How are the different levels of autonomic dysfunction after a brain injury? What are things that people can experience?
Yeah. So dysautonomia is a really just big umbrella term. And so it just ultimately means that there is dysfunction between the relationship between your parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. So what I mean by that, to get even like a bit more simple, is there are situations where we would expect in a healthy nervous system that our parasympathetics would kick in or be activated at certain times. And that when we do that test and an assessment, that might not happen. So the sympathetic system is, we're getting more of a sympathetic response. And those are, again, those are like heart rate measures and things like that, as opposed to the parasympathetic. So dysautonomia is just like a really big umbrella term of dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system. And so you could have minimal dysfunction that people live with on a day-to-day that don't even realize it, or you could have that definitely more significant dysfunction that is 100% life impacting. So you had mentioned POTS. And so POTS stands for postural orthostatic tachycardic syndrome. And it is a type of dysautonomia. And with POTS, again, there can be varying degrees of POTS as well. But for people with really severe POTS, what that means for them is that when they stand up, tachycardic is a really rapid heart rate. It means their heart rate starts to speed up so much, they get lightheaded, they get dizzy, and some people will just faint. For some people, they stand up and they heart, so the heart rate escalates, but they're able to kind of take some breaths and control and then go on. But that is what POTS is. So POTS is a form of dysautonomia. POTS also in itself has different kinds of POTS. So what I will say, with many concussions, POTS is a secondary POTS, which means it has come on because of an incident like the concussion trigger.
That's so helpful.
Yeah. There are other incidences where people are born with congenital things that have led to POTS or low blood volume, but with much of concussion it's that secondary diagnosis because of the trigger of the concussion.
And that's what we're talking about today, because our listeners are brain injury survivors or family members or whoever's listening. But, you know, I don't have POTS. I was in vestibular therapy and I was noticing I was getting super lightheaded all the time. And so my therapist started doing, she would have me sit, take my blood pressure and heart rate, and then have me stand. And then she would do it. And she said, hey, like, I'm noticing a really big difference. So they referred me to a cardiologist. Now, this was before I ever knew about functional neurology or anything. So they referred me to a cardiologist. And so I went to the cardiologist. They did a tilt table test, a Holter monitor, EKG. And they, the doctor was, had enough finesse to notice that, yes, there were irregularities and my symptoms were increasing. I did not have POTS because I wasn't fainting and it wasn't that severe, but it was, he diagnosed me with dysautonomia and that it was serious enough that it was causing me moment by moment issues all the time, sitting to standing. But see, for so many years, I just thought I was lightheaded because I had a brain injury. I had no idea, like that. I thought brain injury was enough of a root cause. I had no idea, like, why I was so lightheaded all the time. I didn't know the words to describe it. And so even the other things, like the cold hands and feet and the gut issues and different things like that, you know, I had no idea that it could all be related. And so this was a huge piece of the puzzle for me in my recovery. That made a huge difference in the way that I was able to approach my recovery and understand things. And so let's move the conversation further into what are some things that will trigger the autonomic system and what are some things, that practical things people can do to help and improve the autonomic system?
Yeah. So I love that you said, because this is going to apply to this too. I love that you said, I thought the brain injury was a root cause enough, right? Of which you've now learned it's not.
Yeah.
Identifying that autonomics is an issue is step one. And then you need to understand the drivers or the roots that are causing that dysfunction, right? So it's all about, as you go through this process of recovery, identifying the area of issue, and then it's another step to identify the roots or the drivers of what's causing that issue, to then have, if I take it a step further, treatment and management strategies. Because I believe you need to have strategies to manage the symptoms in the moment, because otherwise, what are you going to do? But then you also have to be having treatment strategies to address that root driver so that it doesn't keep living symptoms. Then you can resolve that area. So there's many, many things that can influence your autonomic nervous system. So obviously, as a physical therapist, the first thing I want to look at, and you've touched on this already too, is, are my other systems, so my vestibular system, my visual system, my cervical system, my somatosensory system, are my other systems operating on point? Are they taking in the world and processing the information from the world the way in which they're supposed to? And is the information that's coming into my central nervous system integrating, communicating properly? I.e., when I look at the world and I see a straight line, does my vestibular system also recognize that that is vertical? Okay. If the sensory systems aren't processing the world properly, long story short, that triggers something in your brain to say, this is an error. And then emotionally, there's a part of your brain called the amygdala that is meant to respond to the error. So you get an emotional response to an error signal, and that emotional response, if that is perceived as a threat or unsafe, is then going to stimulate your sympathetic nervous system. If it's safe, then you're probably going to stay in more parasympathetic. So one way is identifying, is there actual rehabable things? So like for you, you talked about your vestibular system. Are there things within the systems that we need to rehab to have function better, because that could be contributing to our autonomics? So that's number one. Number two is it's your thoughts, right? So it's what you think. It's how you speak to yourself. Are you finding that when you're presented with a scenario, and this is a lot of exploratory work on yourself, when you're presented with a scenario, where does your mind go? Does it go to, oh my gosh, this means I'm going to be in bed for 3 days? Or does it go to, okay, deep breath, I can do this? Those thoughts that you have are going to trigger an emotional response in your brain. And that response is going to trigger either one of threat or safety, right? Inflammation in the body. So your nutrition is a key piece of things. So anytime you have inflammation, it's just going to impact your ability to heal as a whole. So when we're working with autonomics, we want to be able to have our internal systems in the best shape they can be in. So things like nutrition can play a really big role in just helping establish a more neutral and like supportive internal environment. I would say for me as a clinician, the two biggest things that I think people need to look at when we're dealing with autonomic dysfunction are the first two I mentioned. Is there an actual system reason where there's errors being produced that we can correct that can contribute to decreasing your autonomic symptoms? And then what are the thought processes and the tools that you're saying to yourself? And that can be, and there's definitely ways you can do that internally, but working with the therapist too, can be really huge in helping control. Because an emotional trigger, for example, we don't get to pick our triggers. They just happen. But identifying what that trigger does to your body, which means we need to start paying attention to how our body feels and responds, and trusting that response, which I get when talking with past clients, and I think we've had this conversation too, can be challenging because you get to this point of, can you trust your body anymore after like years of working through a concussion, like concussion and the symptoms it gives you?
Also years of pushing through headaches and pushing through pain.
Yeah.
Through stress. You know, you don't even recognize stress for what it is because you're so used to just having to just try and survive that you're just so used to pushing through. You don't even know how to listen to your body because you have spent years practicing ignoring your body.
Right. Yeah. And so I always say giving yourself the invitation, right? So never forcing anything on yourself. But if you recognize there's a scenario that is a trigger, and journaling is one of the most powerful tools I could give you. Whether you journal by literally dictating a note into your phone, whether you journal by typing into your phone, whether you journal by actually taking out a pen and paper and writing it down, whatever medium works for you. But it's that you get a trigger and you might notice that a thought pattern starts. Or you might notice that your body, I always get really nauseous is my worst symptom. Nausea is my like. And you just sit there and you literally just become an observer of like, here's how my body's responding. And then this is where having a trauma therapist can be very helpful because they can help you backstep to be like, okay, here's this. And they can help you repaint that narrative. But understanding your emotional triggers and being able to process them and be aware of your body and find new ways is a huge, huge step in the healing of your autonomic.
Wow. That's not normally talked about either. So I really appreciate this.
Yeah, like as a therapist for me, and what I say to clinicians too is saying is, if our treatment, okay, so actually this has happened to me clinically, so this is why I bring this up. So we don't know the full story of our clients that are coming through the door. We just don't know. Everyone comes with a history, right? And there's going to be times where people have triggers that they don't recognize as a trigger until something happens. But when you're dealing with someone, I feel like in this day and age, just trauma is a very present thing. And there's been clients that, like, or clients that I've had come in that I know they need, like, vestibular rehab is something we need to do. Like, zero question. All my objective evidence shows it. With all their symptoms that they talk about, show it. But I can't do it because it might be the act of me putting my hands on their face or whatever it is, or just being in the clinic or whatever it is, their threat level already sits so high that doing any additional stimulus tops them over into more of that fight or flight response. And if we push our nervous systems into a constant state of sympathetics, of which, remember, is that mobilization from threat or immobilization to shut down for safety. Mm-hmm. Neither of those two places are a place for healing.
So when you say your threat level is really high, can people think that feels like anxiety?
Yeah.
Because I feel like sometimes when my autonomic system, like when my heart rate is going fast and, you know, it's like, I feel like I'm anxious, but then I'm like, I'm actually not anxious about anything, but like my body is acting like I'm anxious. And so like, I might read it as anxiety, or I might, you know, not know why I'm like, why am I like, I remember being like, why am I so anxious? Why am I so anxious? But like, I wasn't anxious. I had dysautonomia.
Yeah. And so that's too, this is one of my mentors talks about this actually. His name's Brian Bogart. He's fabulous. But he talks about how, and has started talking about, we don't necessarily have to label something with anxiety. Mm-hmm. Because in the past, those emotions have been labeled as anxiety. But like you just said, you're like, I know I'm not anxious, but this is what I'm feeling.
But I'm feeling it. Yeah.
And so it's more like pull out the journal and just like document and be present to like, here's what I'm feeling. And it doesn't feel great and it doesn't make me feel comfortable. So then coming back to like, okay, can we start to work through this? So, but that is exactly what I mean.
Like learning what's triggering you and what's causing it. So, I know we're running a little bit short on time. The last thing I really want to ask, and you can also add in other things, but last thing I really want to ask on this topic is related to if somebody has this problem and in the moment, you know, what do they do? Like, I've heard breath work, I've heard different things, like, but what can somebody do in the moment if they are having trouble with their autonomic system and they're feeling like really out of it? What are some simple things they can do to restore that balance?
I mean, I tell you the ones that I do for my own system. So number one is journaling, because in that, for me, and for a lot of what happens is if you feel that rapid heart rate, there's usually thoughts that are accompanying that. So literally it's like, pull out your phone, pull out your journal and just like document, just verbal vomit everything out, because getting it out then takes it, removes it from the internal and now it becomes external. Instead of you just having to constantly ruminate over that piece. That's number one. Number two, breath. I know people probably get sick of hearing how powerful breathing is, but you're hearing about it all the time because it is such a powerful tool. It's that finding that place. I always say find somewhere to sit or lie down or connect with a wall, because the more you can also ground yourself, it brings you back to the present moment you're in, instead of letting your brain travel to the forward or to the past, right? So you ground yourself in where you're at. And this is what I do all the time too. And then I just sit and I close my eyes so I can block out the visual stimuli of the world. And I just breathe. And normally there's different types of breathing patterns. If you can breathe through your nose, the thought is that that might be better. But my favorite one still to this day is the internal, 4-second count in through my nose. I hold it And then I do like the, I'm just going to do it. So I breathe in through my nose and I hold, and then it's out through the mouth, through the back of the throat. So you think that yoga breath, except I'm not a yoga teacher, so I don't actually know what it's called, but it's that throat, that exhale through the back of the throat too. And that is my favorite by far breathing strategy. And I will sit there and I will do it until I can get myself calm. The other thing that I will say has been absolutely game changing for me is cold water therapy. So for me, I live in Canada and I live by the ocean and I have a lake. So for me, cold water therapy is immersing myself in the ocean every morning. I do it at least 3 mornings a week for anywhere from 2 to 4.5 minutes for me. And there's a lot of research around the power of cold water therapy and what it does for helping, in essence, reset your nervous system, helping your immune system. But then again, when you're in that cold water scenario, it's another moment that forces you to be present and to control your breath and bring in that parasympathetic system again. So what I always say to people, please don't start by just going into an ocean or a lake. But I'll say to clients who are interested in it, just start by, when you wash your face in the morning, fill your hands with cool water to start, and then just put your face in it. Some people progress that to cold water showers. Some people progress that to baths, or some people do like I do and go in the ocean. Obviously talk with your healthcare providers, because if you have circulation issues, things like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Truthfully, breath, journaling, cold water therapy. The kicker is that if you're consistent in those three things every single day, it accumulates for its effectiveness. Right? So taking care of our autonomic nervous system is truly a daily act of self-love.
That's good. Thank you so much. So are there any last words of hope you would have for our listeners today?
Oh, I think I always say the same one. I want you to know that it's never too late. You know, there's still that silly myth that, you know, you only have this long to recover from a brain injury, or after this many months or years, the number changes all the time, that this is as good as you're going to get. And that's not true, right? We are human beings. We are plastic in nature. We were created to be able to evolve, and that never stops. So no matter how long you've been on this journey, know that there's always steps you can take and do if you choose to improve your health and wellness.
That's great. Thank you so much, Natasha. And, you know, I have so much hope just hearing you talk about this too, because just also knowing that there's so much more research coming out and there's so many more providers that are getting educated in concussion, like through your program, that Concussion Nerds. And so I think it's wonderful. So thanks so much for coming on the podcast again. Number three.
My pleasure.
I'll definitely probably have you back again soon.
You're wonderful. Good.
Thanks so much, you. Natasha. And if people want to get in touch with you, can you just share your Instagram handle?
Yeah, so it's at natasha.wilch.
And I will put that in the show notes as well. Perfect. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in to Hope Survives Podcast. I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Make sure to subscribe and stay tuned, as more episodes will be coming each week. And check out hopeafterheadinjury.com for more. I'll see you next time. And remember, there's always hope.